Welcome to the Transform Your Mind Radio Hour and Podcast, a show about transformation, mindset transformation. This is Life Coach Marnie Young, and in my book, Out of the Snares, A Story of Hope and Encouragement, I share my journey of being born in poverty in Guyana to have an abundance in America. And I did it by changing my mindset. Let's go do it. Each week, I bring you guests or one-on-one coaching sessions to help you change your mindset and transform your life.
Welcome back to the Transform Your Mind to Transform Your Life radio podcast and television show. I'm your host, Life Coach Marnie Young. And sitting in the guest chair today is Dr. Thomas R. Burney, author of The Embodied Mind, Understanding the Mysteries of Cellular Memory, Consciousness, and Our Bodies. And today, we're going to be talking on the topic of the mind-brain connections, the mind's relationship with our bodies. Welcome, Dr. Burney.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Yes, it is definitely my pleasure. Listen, I love the mind. I love everything to do with the mind and the body. And we're also going to touch on, you know, where the mind is and all that. So that's amazing. I'm definitely going to understand this conversation. And for you listeners out there, this is something that you need to listen to the end, because Dr. Burney is going to be teaching us about how we can use our mind to transform our lives, which is what the show is all about, and that my mission in life. So awesome. All right. So let me give you guys a short bio on Dr. Thomas R. Burney. He is a clinical psychiatrist and author of 8 books, including The Secret Life of the Unborn Child, which was published in 27 countries and 47 scientific papers. He has previously taught at Harvard University, the University of Toronto, York University, which is also in Toronto, St. Mary's University. And his book, The Embodied Mind, is a profoundly important synthesis revealing how cells utilize consciousness to not only manifest their life function, but more importantly, to create a distributed nervous system that coordinates and supports life-sustaining behavior in multicellular communities, such as those comprising the human body. You know that we are, you know, I was just listening to something the other day, and they're talking about the amount of neurons in our brain. It's like 13 trillion or something. So, and that's just in our brain. And so we definitely are a multicellular community. So, Dr. Thomas,
yes.
Can you share your journey from a clinical psychiatrist to best-selling author of 8 books? And I also love the fact that you work with Dr. Bruce Lipson, and he gave you a great testimonial for your book. I follow Dr. Bruce Lipson's work, and I would love to have him on the show, so put in a good word for me.
Oh, I will. Actually, I have a podcast myself, and I'm interviewing Bruce Lipson next month, actually. Yes.
Oh, you're kidding. Yeah. That's awesome. Right.
It's very hard. It's very hard to get him on a show. He's so popular.
I know. Yes,
I will put in a good word,
put in a good word for me.
Yes.
All right. So tell us your journey. And I'm also the fact that you're also Canadian. So yes. Am I. So yes.
Right. Yes. Fellow Canadians here.
Yes.
We have an hour, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I will take about 10 minutes to answer this question. It actually started when I was 13 years old. My parents and I, we found ourselves in Vienna, and I did not speak any German at that time. And we were renting a place in Vienna, and there were some books there on the bookshelf. And one of the books on the bookshelf was Freud's Interpretation of Dreams. And like I said, I didn't speak any German, so I had a German-Czech dictionary in my hand, and gradually, word for word, gradually, I started translating the book. And as I became better at German, I read more and more of that book, and I just loved it. I just loved the way it was written, the way Freud's mind worked. And I liked sort of the inward journey, you know, deeper and deeper into the unconscious. I loved that journey. And and it was like being a psychic detective, you know, finding out what's really troubling you. So at that point, I made up my mind that I would become a psychiatrist. And so then we came to Canada in 1952, my parents and I. I was successful in entering the medical faculty in Toronto, and I became a doctor. But before I became a doctor, there were a lot of my professors who had a very low opinion of psychiatry. And essentially, they saw psychiatrists as serving very rich ladies who were only concerned about their poodle's health. And psychiatrists really, you know, didn't do anything useful. Not like us, you know, the internists or surgeons.
So you painted a picture of, you know, this rich person just sitting on the couch and just talking, right? Yeah, that's the picture I'm getting.
So that was very discouraging. You know, I didn't want to spend the rest of my life seeing rich ladies or rich gentlemen, you know, worrying about nothing. But that between my third and fourth year of medicine, I went to be what was called at that time an extern at a mental hospital, Middletown State Hospital, actually, north of New York. And I got the grandly sum of $200 a month for my services. Yes, wasn't that something? I was given like total freedom to do as I wanted. They asked me, where did I want to work? We had 5,000 patients at that facility. We had about 30 doctors. And so, you know, there was a great need for doctors. And so I said, I would like to work in emergency when new patients just came in. And so that's where I started working. And I didn't know really very much about psychiatry. All I knew was that there's such a thing as depression and schizophrenia and a few things like that. And then, of course, I remembered my Freud. And so I started seeing new arrivals, and I would talk to them and get their history. And then I would ask them to bring in their family members, and I would talk about the family constellations and what was going on at the time that they got sick. Well, the word got around very quickly that there was actually a doctor here who talked to patients, because the other doctors didn't. They prescribed medications, and then they disappeared and left the nurses to look after the patients. Like, nobody talked to these patients. They were kind of, you know, sort of considered like lost cases, most of them. So, you know, what can we do? We can just give them drugs and that's it, you know, warehouse them. Well, very quickly, there were these huge lineups in front of my office of people wanting to talk to me. You know? And then, of course, the reward was that my patients started getting better, and they improved like twice as fast, three times as fast as the other doctor's patients. And so when I saw that happening, you know, when it was right there, like these were really sick people, and they were getting better. And so I wasn't treating just, you know, rich ladies with poodles. I was treating real people with real pain.
With real problems, right?
So that's when I made up my mind that I would become a psychiatrist, and I did. And so when I started seeing patients, one day, after about 2 years into my practice, I was discussing a dream with one of my patients, and suddenly he started crying like a little baby. And he continued like that for about 10 minutes. And then he came out of it, so to speak. And I asked him what happened. And he said he had just found himself in a baby crib. He was a baby crying for his mother.
Oh, wow.
And then, being a somewhat sort of critical person, skeptical perhaps is a better word, skeptical young lawyer he was, he said, you know, there's something wrong with this picture, because just now, a minute ago, I found myself in a white crib, and I have actually seen photographs of myself as a baby, and they were in a blue crib. They were not in a white crib. There's something wrong with this picture. So I told him to go home, speak to his mother. Next week, he came back and he said, this is amazing. It seems that the first few months of my life, my parents did not have enough money. They could not buy me a crib. They borrowed a crib from a neighbor. That crib was white.
It was white.
A few months later, they bought me a crib. That was blue. That's where all the pictures were taken. So when I heard that, you see, I was very well educated. I went to the University of Toronto. I went to Harvard. We were always taught that children before the age of 2 could not remember anything. So this was impossible. This did not happen. There's something wrong with this. So I kind of put it out of my mind. But after a while, I started having more and more experiences like that. Both myself and other people started telling me when I heard about it, when they heard about my interest. So just to shorten my story. So then I wrote a paper on everything that I knew about prenatal life. And there was a huge conference in Rome, Italy. The Fifth World Congress on Psychosomatic Obstetrics and Gynecology. And I submitted a paper, and lo and behold, I mean, luck sometimes is really important in life, as I'm sure you will agree.
Yeah, I agree.
And so it was accepted. I was like a totally unknown young psychiatrist from Toronto. It was accepted. But not only was it accepted, but it was put on the same morning as some of the biggest lights in psychosomatic obstetrics in the world were presenting their papers. So I was right up there. I was right up there with all the luminaries. And I got 20 minutes. I got 20 minutes. And I noticed within 10 minutes into my talk that there was tremendous interest in the audience about what I was saying. I called it the psychic life of the unborn child. And it was, you know, you could just feel electricity in the air. And so I said at the end of my lecture, end of my talk, I said, well, if anybody here would like to continue the conversation, please come to my room at 5 o'clock. And at 5 o'clock, huge numbers of people, just like at the hospital, you know, lined up. And they lined up. And so I got to know, you know, some of these people. And when I saw their enthusiasm, and when I saw that these really, really knowledgeable people thought that I was really promoting sort of some new ways of looking at prenatal life, that's when I made up my mind to write the book, which then became 2 years later, The Secret Life of the Unborn Child.
Nice.
I'm going to ask you.
I remember that I told you I wanted to talk about that. Let me stop you here for a minute.
Sure.
So the gentleman that was in your chair, he went back to when he was a baby, he was already born. When you're talking about the unborn child, you're talking about the fetus though, right?
Yes, I am. Yes. Okay, going back further. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that was the beginning, because he remembered things that when he was, you know, just a few days old. And we were taught in school that that's impossible, that, you know, your nervous system is not mature enough to be working like that and all that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I wrote the book, and it is based on very solid research that shows that certainly from the 6 months after conception, the nervous system is mature enough to be able to lay down some, you know, pretty simple primitive memories. And there's lots of research to back that up. So that was not a problem.
If you're a person who enjoys wearing nice apparel with a positive message like rest in peace, negative thinking, then Fly Pup is the brand for you. Fly Pup's statement is start the day with self-belief. Fly Pup is an acronym that means fearless, loving, intelligent, peaceful, empowering, phenom. Our apparel is unisex. We offer sizes extra small to 5 extra large in tees and hoodies. Get yours today while supplies last. All our sweatshirts and hoodies are made with 100% relaxed cotton and organic and eco-friendly materials. Visit flypup.shop today. They have Black Friday sales starting right now. Radio and podcast listeners get an extra 20% off the sales price with coupon code JUSTBELIEVE. We look forward to you becoming a part of the Fly Pup family. Follow us on Instagram at FLI_PEP. That website again is www.flipep.shop.
What became a problem for me, and I'm slowly working my way to the book, embodied mind. So what was a problem for me was that although I could prove, the evidence was solid, was scientific, that children from the age of 6 months after conception would be able to remember things that happened to them in the womb prior to birth, and of course, after birth. There were a lot of reports in the literature and a lot of personal experiences that I had with patients where they seemed to be able to go back further in time, back to 3 months, some people even to conception. And some people seemed to carry information from their parents' experiences, you know, big traumas like drowning or being in a war or things like that. And so I asked myself, how is this possible? Like, how can I show this to be scientifically true? Because I was not interested, you know, in a lot of stories. I was interested in science, right?
Science, right.
Mm-hmm. And so that bothered me. The book, The Secret Life of the Unborn Child, was published in 1982. So, you know, that's a long time ago. And so, and I was asked to talk about it, and I did, you know, all over the world, globally. I have talked about The Secret Life of the Unborn Child. But like I say, I was worried that there was no explanation for memories going back further. So seven years ago, in one of the science journals that I read all the time, I came across a report about a French, 44-year-old Frenchman who went to see his doctor because of a weakness in his left leg. And then he had all kinds of tests done. And lo and behold, when they did an X-ray of his head, they found out that he had virtually no brain tissue. He had a thin crescent of brain tissue, and the rest of his skull was filled with fluid. We call it hydrocephalus in medicine, just fluid on the brain. So this
and yet he was functional.
Not only was he functional, he was a husband, he had 2 children, and he worked in the French civil service. He had a good job. He never had any problems in life, except at the age of 44, he had this weakness in his left leg. So I said to myself, how is this possible? How is this possible? And how come nobody has ever asked that question, you know?
Yeah.
So then I started looking into the literature, and I found that actually there were a lot of reports, particularly of children who had intractable epilepsy. And the only way, you know, little children who would have an epileptic attack like 6, 7, 8 times a day, which destroyed their brains.
Mm-hmm.
So very often what surgeons did was that they removed a part of their brain. Sometimes half a brain would be removed.
I saw that on television recently where somebody removed half of the brain to cure epilepsy. Yes, I saw that. I don't remember who it was, but it was on television.
Yeah. So there you go. If it was on television, it must be true, right? So I looked into that, and it became clear to me that there are a lot of people running around with half a brain or almost no brain. And, you know, speaking of television that you saw recently, there was an article in September in the New York Times by a woman called Helen Santoro, which was entitled The Curious Hole in My Head. She was born without a temporal lobe.
Mm.
And yet, you know, and after she was born, the doctors noticed that, you know, that there was something wrong with her. They did all kinds of x-rays. They told her mother that she would have to be institutionalized for the rest of her life, that she would be like totally abnormal.
Mm-hmm.
She grew up totally normal without any difficulties, excelled at sports, and has a very good job and continues to live a good life. So
temporal lobe, what does that control again? I'm trying to go back into my brain here.
The temporal lobe is sort of here on the right-hand side, right?
Uh-huh.
So it would control, like, if it's on the left side, it would control language. So this person would have great difficulty, if at all possible, to speak language. It controls a lot of memory.
Okay.
So cognitive functions would be influenced by that. So it would be noticeable. Like there's, I mean, the doctors, in a sense, were right. You know, a person in their estimation and in their experience, they have never seen a person like that who was able to act normally.
Right.
So anyway, so when I started researching this and looking at how the cells in the body work, I became convinced that it's really the cells in the body, all the cells in the body, not just the brain, work together.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is connected, and it is ridiculous to think of the brain as kind of being separate from the body and not being connected to the rest of the body. And so what I've come to see is that the cells in the body, the tissues, the organs like the heart especially, but also the gut, they all act as kind of a backup system to the brain. And so it's when something goes wrong with the brain, we still have our, you know, backup system, just like the iCloud, right?
I think I'm getting where you're going with this now. Right. Go ahead. Yeah.
When something goes wrong with the brain, the backup system comes online, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what neurologists say, what sort of your orthodox conservative neurologists, neuroscientists will say is that that other systems in the brain take up the slack. But there is no research to prove that at all. There's no evidence to show that. I think it's much more likely, and again, you know, in my book, The Embodied Mind, I bring up a lot of research evidence to show that the cells in the body are really not much different from neurons in the brain. And so they have all the elements that the neurons in the brain have, except that they're connected a little bit differently. So I think to make it short, to make my answer a little shorter, I think that what we need to realize is that for a long time, we have given too much advantage. We have stressed the importance of the brain over the importance of the rest of the body. And so, you know, it also goes with our culture, which is very patriarchal and hierarchical. And as a result of that, you know, the emphasis is always on the leader, the head honcho, right? Mm-hmm. Who is the head of government? Who is the head of your research? Who is the head of your radio station? And instead of that, you know, who is heading this project? Instead of that, we need to balance things a little bit more, okay? We need to get away from this top-down kind of attitude to the bottom-up also. So top-down and bottom-up need to be more balanced. We need a more nuanced approach to health. And I don't know, you know, what other questions you have, but I think
I've got a couple of circle backs. So one is that I heard that a hypnotist can take you back to the womb.
Yes.
So the patients that you were talking to that went back to their womb, were they hypnotized, or how did you get them to access that memory?
No. I have used hypnosis once in a while, never really terribly successfully. The people who returned sort of to earlier experiences did that all on their own without any help from me. In a sense, they would just, some kind of a memory would come up, something would trigger that backward journey. But it was not instituted by me. Sometimes people, you know, after The Secret Life of the Unborn Child was published, sometimes people would come to me and ask me to take them back to earlier times. And I would do that again in a very sort of non-directive fashion. You know, I would say things like, you know, what is the first memory that you have in your life? And then, you know,
vitamin, mine is 5 years old. I don't go back any further than that, I don't think.
right. But you probably could, you know, with a little help, you probably could. But, you know, a lot depends on, it's really the emotions very often that take you back to earlier times. Okay. And so I want to make it very clear that I did not use hypnosis, and that people just went back on their own. When they were ready, they would go
back. They were able to go back, Okay.
And this can be done in many different ways. You know, it can be done with psilocybin, LSD, hypnosis. I don't know whether you've ever heard of rebirthing.
But I don't remember. I heard a term, but I don't know what it entails.
It's a certain way of breathing that very often takes you back further in time. What you can really do, some of your listeners can do this on their own, that if you have children, very, very young children, 2.5 to 4.5 years old, when you, at bath time in the evening, as they are relaxing in a bathtub, just playing with some bath toys, whatever, you can ask them, what do you remember about your birth? And it is amazing sometimes what children will come out with. Just,
you're kidding me. Wow.
No.
Wow, that's really beautiful.
Ask some of your patients, some of your clients, some of your listeners.
Yeah.
This is a psychiatrist talking, you know. Ask some of your listeners just to try that out between the ages of 2.5 and 4.5. After 4.5, children tend to forget.
But if you get,
and not any leading questions, just, you know, what do you remember? What was it like? You know, what was it like?
And that's amazing. That's amazing. Well, I have a grandson that's 1.5 years, so I'm gonna wait and test that out myself with him.
when they start talking, which is usually between 1.5 and 2.5,
right?
You would be amazed, you know, at the things that children tell you, you know, and the fact that they're in the water and relaxing is very important. You see, before birth, they were in the amniotic sac.
Right.
They were surrounded by water. So it helps them to go back.
Oh, that's amazing. All right. I love that. I'm going to do that myself for my grandson. Okay. All right. Now, the second circle back I had is that you talked about the backup system of the brain. Now, I've always heard that that the gut is a second brain.
Yes.
But I was under the impression that it's a second brain for our bodies. But I think what I'm hearing you say is that it's a backup for your main brain. So how does that work? Take us through what that really means.
Yeah. I think that everything in the body working together is a backup. I know that the gut has been referred to as the second brain, and there is good reason for that. The gut has got a tremendous number of neurons in it. And it creates, of course, some very, very important substances, such as serotonin, for example, which is very important in terms of how you feel. Like people with depression, for example, are supposed to have less serotonin. And one of the reasons that they are depressed is because they lack serotonin. Mm-hmm. Most people don't realize that most of the serotonin in the body is actually produced in the gut.
Okay.
We have the vagus nerve, which is the 10th cranial nerve. We have 12 nerves coming out of our brain. And number 10, the vagus nerve, is the most important one because it goes to the heart. And from the heart, it also goes to the gastric.
I tried to stimulate that every day when I do my meditation.
Oh, yeah?
I'm very familiar with that one. Yes.
Okay. So, you know, that is, but of course, it's a two-way street. Mm-hmm. We often think of the vagus nerve as sort of from the brain to the heart, from the heart to the gut. But we hardly ever also discuss the other way, you know, traffic along the route from the gut to the heart to the brain. Mm-hmm. So, but then again, you know, we have the blood circulation. And the blood is in contact with all the cells in our bodies. So when we talk about the second brain, it's really inaccurate because it's just another organ in the body that stimulates the brain and the rest of the body. I will give you a metaphor that perhaps best describes how I sort of picture the body working. I think of it as a very large orchestra, like, let's say, you know, the New York Symphony.
Right.
Mm-hmm. With 100, let's say 120 musicians, one conductor. So each musician plays an instrument, and most of the instruments are different. But the person sitting in the audience does not hear 120 instruments. The person in the audience hears one sound, right? Emanating from the orchestra. That's how our memories work. That's how our brain works, okay? But instead of having 120, we have 120 billion or whatever billion, it is. Right. I forget the number.
Billion, right.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, we have a lot of musicians playing here, and they're all contributing. And of course, if there is a problem with one of the organs, then the whole system suffers. And I think that, you know, that's one of the problems with medicine today, is that it is so focused on one particular organ. You know, cardiologists only deal with the heart, neurologists only deal with the nerves, gastroenterologists only deal with the stomach and the abdomen and all that stuff. So I think that one of the implications of my work is that we need to become much more holistic in our approach, okay?
Yeah.
And since you meditate every day, you would appreciate the fact that when you meditate, you know, it's the whole body that's involved. It's not just your brain, right? It's your breathing, for example, that's important, right?
You're relaxing, you're clearing your mind, you're focusing, you're doing all these different things, and you do it actually to combine the body, brain, the combination. So that's great. But one of the important questions I had here that I had written down, and I've heard this before by Deepak Chopra and, you know, those scientists, that the mind is not in the brain. So let's talk about that. For a minute.
Yes.
Where is the mind?
Where is the mind? Yes, I'm sorry about the telephone. Just a second. I'm just going to stop it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Again, conservative academic neuroscientists think of the mind as an epiphenomenon of the brain. In other words, it's a function of the brain. Epi is just another word for function. So epiphenomena, it's a function of the brain. Just like urine is a function of the kidneys, or bile is a function of the gallbladder.
Right. Okay.
But when you think about this, you know, I mean, any normal person, if they think about this analogy, they can see that it's a mistaken analogy, because the mind is not like urine. You know, you can't see it. You can't measure it.
Right.
You
can't
quantify it. You can't do research on it. It is, you know, the mind, it's like beauty or love. You cannot quantify it. It's a whole different phenomenon.
Yeah.
So to say that it is a function of the brain doesn't make sense. I think that the mind is a function of the whole body again, you know, because all of these cells work together. It's not one, but we have never been able to locate the mind or consciousness in the brain. In spite of what, you know, scientists have tried to do. You know, you spoke about hypnosis a minute ago. There are some very, very interesting studies on near-death experiences. Perhaps you have heard of those?
Yeah. I've interviewed several on the show, so I'm intimately connected with it.
Right. Okay. So, you know, very often you will have people who will have died, even for all intents and purposes. I actually experienced that with a patient when I was working in a hospital, and his heart stopped beating, and I gave him into the heart. I put adrenaline, a vial of adrenaline, directly into the heart. About a few minutes later, he came back, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then he described in great detail what had happened in the room.
Apparently you're supposed to have left your body and you're watching it all from someplace up here, right?
Yes, exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, how do you explain that? You can't explain that. There's no explanation except to say that the mind is definitely, you know, dependent on the body, but also independent of it. There is a kind of, it's the mind may very well be, you know, one of those elements of the universe, like gravity or electrical charges, which have always been here. And we kind of borrow from it in some way, you know. We have a tiny bit of that greater mind, perhaps, that exists out there. And it certainly, you know, is connected to the body, but it also in some ways is independent of the body. And so that's the reason I called my book The Embodied Mind, because it's not just the enskulled mind, okay? It's not just in the brain. It's not just in the head. It's the whole total body. And who knows what happens after we die? You know, some of it may persist, and who knows?
Yeah. Wow. That's you're right. That's another topic.
Yeah.
Now talking about the mind, reading your work, I see that you also kind of like equate it to the Matrix, right? Where you're in this alternate universe where, you know, things are happening in the Matrix. So let's say that, you know, someone that's listening is getting this conversation where, so we've got the brain and we've got the body and we've got a backup system. So how can they use this information to, transform their lives, for a better term?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's a very good question. Right. There are many answers to that question. One of them is that the mind is incredibly powerful. And we just don't appreciate how important the mind is. Let me just give you a very simple example. There was a study done, it's mentioned in my book, by a Harvard psychologist, Ellen Langer. And it's a very simple study, and it's just so beautiful. She studied 82 hotel maids in New York, and she divided them into two groups of 41. And to one group, she said that the work that they do actually follows and lives up to the Surgeon General's recommendations for daily exercise. So like their work is like exercise, like some people go to the gym, but you work. Mm. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. And so the other group was not told that, was told something quite different. At the end of 30 days, they measured all kinds of measurements on these maids. They found that the 41, the group that believed that they were exercising, lost weight. Mm-hmm. They decreased waist to hip ratio, and they had a 10% drop in blood pressure. Yeah. And they did nothing different from the other group.
Yeah.
They only believed.
Mind is powerful. It's powerful. Yep.
They only believed that they were
exercising.
Now the same thing, you know, happens with placebos. You know, you can tell.
Yeah. Yeah,
you can tell someone, you know, that this is going to take your headaches away. And it does, you know, nine times out of 10.
And as a psychiatrist, you also know the fact where belief is so important. Now, someone coming and sitting on your couch and believe something, regardless if it's true or not, that's how their body and their mind and their whole world is going to respond.
Right. So, you know, in terms of practical advice, it's very, very important for people to change their attitude towards their own bodies and towards themselves. You know, there are unfortunately a lot of people around with low self-esteem. There are a lot of people around who have been criticized as children. I just saw a patient yesterday, you know, and he was always very enthusiastic. And sometimes he would, like, if the teacher would ask a question, he would sort of speak out without putting up his hand, and he would be punished for that, and he would be told to be quiet, instead of, you know, a good teacher would say, yeah, okay, that's very good, but perhaps next time you could put up your hand first, you know.
Right.
It's the right answer. I love your enthusiasm. But instead of that, you know, he was put down. So now, you know, even when he goes shopping, he's afraid that somebody might ask him a question. He might not be able to come up with the right answer. I mean, he's just full of anxieties.
Wow. Yeah. So, can you believe a simple thing like that has such far-reaching
consequences? Well, no, I think there would have to be a few more follow-ups like that.
Right.
But they all kind of come together. They gel together.
Yeah.
And they kind of gradually you sort of formulate a life script about yourself, you know, and you start thinking negative thoughts about yourself. And so, you know, my advice is be honest, look in the mirror and look at yourself. And if you find that there are certain things you don't like about yourself, well, face that and make it better, improve it. Don't go around trying to cover up. That's not the way to do it. Okay. Get it out of your system. Find out why you think that you are not beautiful or that you are not clever or whatever it is that, you know, your negative beliefs are. Get rid of them. So, and believing, you know, talk to your friends, ask them why they like you. And you will be astonished and you will say, really?
Because you never see it yourself, right?
Right? And so when you get that kind of a feedback, then perhaps you can start believing in it. And if you believe in it, well, then you will become it. So the
mind is very important.
Really, really, really powerful. So that's one thing, you know. And the other thing is, you know, we have to take care of your body. Because if your body is diseased, your mind becomes diseased. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the Greeks a long time ago had this saying about a healthy mind in a healthy body. And it is so true. And some people in our society are just so busy. They are so ambitious. Everybody wants to make money and more money. And so they don't pay any attention to their bodies because they're busy.
They do not make it a priority at all. Right. Exactly. They say, I don't have no time. And they don't.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I agree with that totally.
And another thing, if I may mention, another thing, your gut bacteria are incredibly important. Okay.
Yeah.
It's called the microbiome. And the gut, there's a lot of research, particularly, you know, older people who are listening should realize that, for example, social isolation will increase your chances of dementia by about 30%.
Wow.
So,
I've never heard that one.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. There's research from England to show that. great deal of research on 30,000 people. It has been shown that social isolation increases, to be exact, I think it was 27.6%. Your risk of developing dementia. It's incredibly important. But one of the interesting things about that is that people who are socially isolated have a very different gut microbiome from people who are socially interactive. So we don't know which came first, you know, the chicken or the egg. But we do know
that
microbiome may have.
We can probably guess, though, that the chicken came before the egg, that when they were socially isolated, that's when their bodies start to change.
Right.
And that would be a good guess. Right.
I think that would be a good guess. And then another good guess would be that people who become socially isolated probably don't eat so well. So that, you know, their diet becomes just much more limited.
Right.
And so the limited diet then will provide you with limited microbes, limited bacteria in your gut. So one thing kind of leads to another.
Right.
So it's very important, you know, for all the people both to have a varied diet and to interact with other people. Very, very important.
Right. Okay, so your work as well you touch on Alzheimer's, and is this part of the brain backup system that you were talking about earlier?
Yes.
So talk about
Well, you know, in terms of Alzheimer's, like everybody is looking at amyloid tissues in the brain, and millions of dollars are being spent by pharmaceutical companies looking into sort of how to prevent amyloid tissues from congregating and being deposited in the brain. But the fact is that research from Australia has recently shown that a lot of amyloid protein is actually produced in the liver. And it is from the liver that it is taken, transported to the brain. But I don't know of any pharmaceutical company in the world that is actually looking into how to prevent the liver from producing amyloid protein. Wow. So, you know, again, it's this total focus on the brain.
On the brain,
which is not serving us well, okay? We really need to get out of that sort of bubble and think outside the box, so to speak, look at the rest of the body, how the rest of the body is contributing to our health and our, you know, mental health, good health and bad health. Yeah.
Right. Okay, this is a good point to add to talk about your book. It is called The Embodied Mind, Understanding the Mysteries of Cellular Memory, Consciousness, and Our Bodies. So tell our listeners about your book. Tell them where they can pick it up, pick up a copy, talk about your website.
Thank you.
What do you want people to walk away with after reading your book?
Well, they can pick up my book on Amazon. It's it's freely available. Well, not, it's not free, but it's easily available.
It's easily available on Amazon.
It's easily
right?
available, and it's not expensive. My website is trwerneymd.com.
Okay.
And they can, if they have any questions, they can get to me through my website.
Okay.
And in terms of what they should walk away from in terms of reading my book, you know, it's very interesting. Different people have different sort of takeaways from my book. Sometimes it surprises me what people find in it. Even things that I never thought about, people find in it.
That's good.
But in a sense, I mean, it's a very rich book because it has an incredible, you know, it has like, I read about 5,000 books and journals in preparation for that book. And 500, it has actually 500 references in the back of the book, scientific references. It has a tremendous amount of information in it. And at the end of each chapter, you have like practical sort of takeaways, you know, what you can sort of take with you that is easy to understand, accessible. But I think the most important feature is just to develop a respect for your mind and how powerful it is, and how it can influence every particle, every cell in your body. How you think about yourself is very, very important. And also, you know, interacting with other people, touching other people is very important. You know, a hug a day keeps the doctor away, as far as I'm concerned.
I thought it was the apple.
No, it's a hug. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I like hugs, so that's good. Okay.
hug at least one person a day, at least once a day. Hug. Make a hug. Nice. Yeah. So I think those things are really, really, really important, and to realize how important also the gut bacteria are, because every day we are learning more and more about the influence of the gut bacteria. For example, just one more thing. People take antidepressants when they are depressed. 1/3 of patients do not benefit from antidepressants. The reason they don't benefit is there's nothing wrong with the drugs. They're pretty good drugs, actually. But some people have bacteria in their gut which destroy those particular antidepressants. And so they don't work. They don't work. And so it would be really important for people like that to have their gut bacteria tested and find out which antidepressants, for example, will work and which will not work.
Right.
So there are just many, many implications to this work.
Right. Well, that sounds really good. Listen, I know the mind is powerful. I know that influences every single part of our you know, I use the mind for things that you want, or whether it's, whether if you want your body, if you want riches, mm-hmm. whether you mm-hmm. want whatever. But what you've done is you've expanded our knowledge to using the mind for the body mm-hmm. to make mm-hmm. your body work better, not right. necessarily to for the law of attraction or for, you know, the placebo effect, you know, right. those type of things.
Yeah.
But yeah, making our you know, our mind, you know, heal, our minds can actually even heal our bodies if we put it to that, mm-hmm. to put it to task to do that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I was very, very excited about talking to you, Dr. Bruni. And yes, you have, as I sat and I listened to you, you know, my consciousness has been expanded. On yes, good. And I will definitely. Is your book on Audible?
Yes, it's no. I think it's only in the reader. What is it called? Kindle.
All right. Yeah, Kindle. The Kindle.
Kindle.
Right.
Kindle.
Right. Right. It's Kindle. Kindle. Okay.
It's
all right. Okay.
It's not on Audible, and the reason that it's not on Audible is because there are a lot of diagrams. To help you understand.
Okay, right, yeah.
So it was really important. It's really important to look at some of those pictures and diagrams.
Right. Well, I asked you that because, you know, I when I walk, I read books, you
me
know,
too.
But
me too.
I also have a I also have a Kindle, so I'll go ahead and get that.
Get
so
a Kindle.
I can,
get a
you know, maybe read it at night and, you know, look at the diagrams and things like that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Because learning is so important, you know, if you want to get anywhere in this world and have a great life, then you need to learn the tools in order to make that happen. So I thank you so much for this beautiful conversation. Thank you for touching on the secret life of the unborn child, because I love that. And that's probably a book that I should read as well.
Yes,
because,
definitely.
Your understanding what happens, you're saying, while mm-hmm. you're in the womb and mm-hmm. in early childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that really sets you up, from what I know, for the rest of your life. So it's very
Absolutely.
Important
yes.
that you kind of understand what goes on there. So
thank
you so much. For the listeners, you know that I would have a transcript of my conversation with Dr. Bruni on the show page, which is blog.myhelps.us, with link to his website. And that website again is trbruni, which is verny.com. Is that correct, Dr. Bruni?
Trbruni, MD.
MD? Okay.
I think so.
All right.
Yeah. just a second. I haven't looked at my I haven't looked at my website for a long time.
In a while, right? Yeah.
Give me one second. Oh my God.
No problem.
Where is it? Where is it? Oh, here we are. It's coming up. Oh, yes. It's trbruni.md.com.
.com. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So that's the website, but I would also have a link out to Dr. Bruni's two books and also his website on the show page. So, yes, very important. So go ahead and pick up maybe one or two of those, and so that you can use your mind to get the best body. And also, you can also use your mind, learn how to use your mind to expand your consciousness and to help with when you are, you know, we're all losing memory as we grow older. And if we learn the tools, then maybe we can stop that. And I love what you said about the liver, Dr. Bruni. And I'm assuming that we're going to have some, you know, people coming out with some, you know, things to help with the liver. To help the liver with Alzheimer's, because yes, as the population is getting older, that has become one of the top things that people are, you know, looking into. So yes, I definitely thank you guys for tuning in. Thank you, Dr. Bruni, for being on the show. Remember to pass on a good word for me to Dr. Lipton.
Absolutely. I will.
And what is the name of your podcast? I can also link out to that.
It's called Pushing Boundaries with Dr. Thomas R. Bruni. Pushing Boundaries with Dr. Thomas R. Bruni.
Okay. All right. So yes, I will definitely link out to that. You know, shout out to that. And you guys can go listen if you You know, you want to learn some tips every week about the mind and pushing your boundaries. Awesome. All right. We're fresh out of time. Any last words, Dr. Bernie?
No, we just wrap up? Thank you. Thank you. I truly enjoyed meeting you. And perhaps we can do this again sometime.
Yes, yes, for sure. I will definitely want maybe to expand on the secret life of the unborn child. I would love to do that. All right. Take care. All right. Well, I love that. Okay. All right, guys. Well, listen, thanks again for tuning in to the Transform Your Mind to Transform Your Life radio podcast and television show. Wishing you blessings. And until next time, namaste.
Namaste.